content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the September 5th, 2014 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Obama's decision to pursue ISIS into Syria. What happened? President Obama took steps to expand America's military operation against the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria this week, authorizing the use of surveillance aircraft over Syria and prodding Western and regional allies to take joint action to defeat the militants. 3 weeks of U.S. airstrikes in Iraq have halted the advance of the Sunni extremist group, but intelligence officials and Pentagon generals are reportedly telling Obama that further strikes are needed in both Iraq and Syria to stop the militants from regrouping and establishing a secure base from which to launch terrorism operations against the West. The White House has been weighing the need for congressional approval for a prolonged air campaign and trying to build a coalition of allies, including Britain, Australia, and Saudi Arabia. Obama said that rooting out a cancer like ISIS won't be easy, and it won't be quick, but that militants would be no match for an international coalition. 6 days after releasing a video showing the beheading of U.S. journalist James Foley, ISIS demanded a $6.6 million ransom for a 26-year-old American woman. The unnamed humanitarian worker was kidnapped in Syria a year ago. What the editorial said. In Iraq, the advance of fanatics bent on devastation has for now been halted, said The Economist. But the jihadist threat is far from over. ISIS still controls a third of Iraq and part of Syria, and is still attracting hundreds of young Muslims from abroad, some of whom will target their own countries. Obama has no choice but to launch a sustained, punishing air campaign in Syria and Iraq. ISIS is too dangerous to be allowed to gain ground. Although Obama has long been reluctant to intervene in Syria's chaotic civil war, events may now be forcing his hand, said the Baltimore Sun. But to what end? Any victory over ISIS in Syria will strengthen President Bashar al-Assad, a dictator who has murdered close to 200,000 of his own people. And airstrikes alone will not erase ISIS. Nonetheless, Obama has already ruled out putting boots on the ground. That's why the U.S. cannot go it alone, said the New York Times. While ISIS poses a significant threat to the West, those paying the biggest price are Muslims. If other Muslim countries in the region can't see ISIS for the threat it is and work together, the extremist will never be defeated. What the columnist said. ISIS militants probably thought their execution video would intimidate and terrorize the world, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. But the pornographic violence of the group's beheadings, crucifixions, and mass slaughter of Shiites, Yazidis, and Christians has disgusted not only the West, but Muslims too. They may well take up Obama's invitation to confront this malignancy. Foley's beheading was horrific, said Aaron David Miller in foreignpolicy.com. But I think few people would argue that Obama should make a major military commitment in Syria to avenge the life of one American. Still, the photos of that barbaric murder have made the ISIS threat feel deeply personal for Americans and rekindled fears of a terrorist attack on U.S. soil. So now Obama will begin a bombing campaign for no other reason than blowing up a bunch of very bad people feels good. Unfortunately, an air campaign won't be very effective, said Joshua Keating in Slate.com. In bombing ISIS in Iraq, the U.S. had detailed knowledge of the terrain, special forces on the ground to pinpoint airstrike targets, and Kurdish allies to mop up afterward. We have nothing of the sort in Syria. Whatever Obama does, his decision to take on ISIS will probably define his presidency, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. In 2008, Obama beat Hillary Clinton and then John McCain in part by promising to extricate the U.S. from wars. That was a very popular idea, until the collapse of Iraq and Syria and the rise of ISIS. If Obama leaves office with the country in more danger than it was 8 years earlier, the rest of his legacy will be for naught. Our controversy of the week, Ferguson, a tipping point for black Americans. When does a moment become a movement? Asked Frederick Harris in WashingtonPost.com. That's the question facing black Americans in the wake of the killing of unarmed black teen Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Now that the protests have faded, the St. Louis suburb could enter history as merely the scene of just another tragic slaying, or as a pivot point, the birthplace of a national movement to change how police departments treat young black and brown men. But for real reform to occur, activists must channel the widespread anger unleashed by this tragic event to form local, regional, and national organizations devoted to fighting racial profiling, police misconduct, stand-your-ground laws, and the militarization of the police. For many of us, Brown's death was a tipping point, said Bob Herbert in Prospect.org. We're sick and tired not only of police shooting young black men, but also of the myriad hateful ways we're discriminated against by the criminal justice system and the police. We've also had enough of the humiliating, debilitating racist encounters, large and small, that nearly all black people face at one time or another. Why turn Brown shooting into the latest excuse for racial conflict, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Race hustlers like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson have taken a complicated legal case and used it to blow racial tension so high that nothing short of the indictment of Darren Wilson, the police officer who shot Brown, will prevent riots from erupting. Brown's case is far from clear-cut. Several eyewitnesses claim that the 6'4", 290-pound teen punched Wilson and later charged him, turning the shooting into a possible act of self-defense. That ambiguity hasn't stopped Attorney General Eric Holder from rushing to judgment, said Linda Chavez in the New York Post. His decision to order a full-scale civil rights investigation before the St. Louis County Grand Jury decides whether to prosecute Wilson fans the very racial tensions Holder says he wants to calm. I feel confident stating that neither Brown nor Wilson is an angel, because no one is, said Tuer in WashingtonPost.com. But in nearly every case of this kind, young black men are thugified for wearing their hats sideways, smoking marijuana, or other mild rebellions that white teens can engage in without being gunned down by cops. Brown's death was a reminder that black lives don't matter in America, said Sally Kahn in TheDailyBeast.com. FBI statistics show that nearly two times a week, every week, a black person is killed by a white officer. This is why 80% of black people say the shooting of Brown raises important issues about race. Sadly, only 37% of whites see it that way. What the hell is black America supposed to do to get white America's attention? Vote, for starters, said Dwayne Wickham, in USAtoday.com. Protesters complain that Ferguson is 67% black, yet only three of Ferguson's police officers are black, while its mayor and police chief are white. But the blame for that imbalance lies mostly with black indifference. In the 2013 local election, just 6% of blacks in Ferguson turned out. If black people want more control over the police and local governments, they have to do more than protest when a teen is shot. They have to get out to the polls in every election. The change they want won't be given to them. Well, it was a good week for rebranding after developers decided to change the name of their West Palm Beach luxury condominium, ISIS Downtown, because that acronym is now associated with Islamic terrorism. It's scarily negative, said a local realtor. It was a good week for resurrections. After a koala that fell out of a tree and was hit by a car in Australia was brought back to life by emergency responders who performed mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. First time I've done CPR on a koala, said one responder. It was a good week for miracles. After a Brazilian man who suffered a heart attack regained consciousness in a body bag in a morgue. Val de Lucio Goncalves, 54, was freed when his grieving brother saw the bag wriggling and then rising and falling as if he were breathing. It was a bad week for gloating. After the British Embassy in Washington, D.C., was forced to apologize when diplomats tweeted a photo of a miniature White House surrounded by sparklers to mark the anniversary of the building's burning by redcoats in the War of 1812. It was a bad week for skirting the law after an Oregon man was arrested when electrical store workers allegedly caught him shoplifting gadgets and hiding them inside his customized kilt. It gives kilts a bad name, said Johnny McLean, the owner of a local kilt store. And it was a bad week for the size matters defense. After a German woman defended her husband in court by testifying that he couldn't possibly be guilty of flashing. I'm sorry, darling, she said, but your penis is too short to hang out of your trousers. And on to the briefing page. The next pandemic. Think Ebola is alarming? Scientists expect a much deadlier virus to emerge in the not-distant future. How likely is a pandemic? Epidemiologists believe we're statistically overdue for a global viral outbreak, which occurs every generation or so. This year's Ebola crisis is probably just a dress rehearsal, though the virus has killed at least 1,420 people in Africa in the last 5 months. Ebola is transmitted only through intimate contact with bodily fluids and doesn't have the global reach of a true pandemic, such as Spanish influenza in 1918. Humanity had no prior exposure or immunity to the Spanish flu, which is believed to have incubated in birds and pigs, so it spread like wildfire, infecting about 500 million people and killing about 50 million of them. The next pandemic is most likely to emerge in a remote region of Asia or Africa from contact between people and poultry, rats, bats, pigs, monkeys, or some other animal. If that virus can be spread through the air or by touch, the way the common cold is, it will sweep from village to city and air travel will allow it to hop continents within hours. A vaccine will take at least months of frantic work to develop. And in the meantime, millions will die. The three deadliest events in human history were all infectious diseases, said medical historian David Morenz. The Spanish flu, the Black Death, also known as the bubonic plague, and AIDS. There are lots of reasons to think more will be coming. Why are animals the likely source? About 60% of the roughly 400 emerging infectious diseases identified since 1940 are zoonotic, originating in animals. Ebola is believed to have originated in bats and HIV in monkeys, and spread to humans when bushmeat hunters slaughtered the animals, exposing themselves to their blood. There are 50,000 vertebrate species, said Peter Daszak of Columbia University. If you assume each one has 20 unknown viruses, that makes a million unknown viruses in wildlife. While these viruses circulate relatively harmlessly within the non-human animal kingdom, a spillover onto a human with no immunity to the disease can be devastating. Unfortunately, such spillovers are becoming more frequent. Why is that? As Earth's population has grown to more than 7 billion, humans have encroached further and further into the habitats of wild animals, unwittingly exposing themselves to a number of unique virulent diseases. The urbanization of Africa and Asia, along with modern air travel, mean that a single infected person can spread a disease to the entire globe. Up to now, we have been bullet dodging, said virologist Nathan Wolf. But now lurking in the jungle are viruses that, if they crossed over, have the capability to kill hundreds of millions of us. How are scientists preparing? Some researchers are focusing on recreating viruses in the lab, such as H1N1 virus, known as the swine flu. By studying its genetic sequence, epidemiologists hope to be able to understand how such viruses evolve and are transmitted. But experimentation carries risks. One virologist, Dr. Ron Fouchier, has been working with the H5N1 avian flu virus, a strain widely considered the worst-case scenario for a future pandemic because of its high death rate, killing 60% of those infected. H5N1 cropped up in 2003, but has yet to spread from one human to another. But in his biosafety level 3 facility in the Netherlands, Fouchier says he has mutated the hell out of the virus so that it is now airborne between ferrets, and potentially between humans too. The U.S. government tried and failed to block Fouchier from publishing his work out of fear it would be used by terrorists seeking to create a catastrophic biological weapon. What else is being done? The research organization Global Viral is trying to create an early warning system that would detect hidden pandemic viruses at their source and contain them before they get out of control. One of the organization's novel approaches is to employ young social media experts to monitor internet searches and Twitter feeds for such key phrases as body ache and high fever, hoping to catch a virus as it goes viral in the newest sense of the term. Virologists, meanwhile, are working on seed vaccines for newly emerging strains of influenza. How can governments help? First of all, by being transparent when there's an outbreak of a new disease. When severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, emerged in China in 2002, Beijing officials initially tried to hide the outbreak from visiting World Health Organization experts by ordering doctors to take SARS patients out of hospitals and drive them around in ambulances. The virus eventually killed 775 people across 37 countries. There have been similar delays in reporting cases of the deadly Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS, in Saudi Arabia in recent years. But the biggest challenge, says infectious disease expert Mark Woolhouse, is persuading the world's governments to fund research into viruses and prepare for a public health crisis that hasn't yet emerged, but almost certainly will. We like to think we discover viruses, he said, but it's also the viruses discovering us. Take a look now at some of the best columns. The first from the U.S., from William Salatin at Slate.com, why the U.S. shouldn't pay ransoms. Should the U.S. have paid a ransom to save James Foley? Asked William Salatin. The gruesome beheading of the American journalist by an ISIS militant last week has prompted many critics to argue that the U.S. needs to rethink its policy against paying ransoms in exchange for kidnapped Americans. While that's a perfectly natural response to Foley's horrifying death, paying ransoms gives terrorists enormous power and would only serve to put more lives in danger. Research has shown that the number of kidnappings more than doubles in response to payments. Every time we ransom a reporter, we put a price tag on the next one. The $132 million ISIS demanded for Foley's release would have helped finance the organization's army and its atrocities against civilians. The ransoms European nations and private companies have paid to Al-Qaeda have become the organization's main revenue stream. That's why the Obama administration was right to reject ISIS's ransom demand and to answer it with more bombing. Terrorists can kill you or me, but it is the civilized world that will ultimately prevail, as long as we refuse to accept the enemy's rules. Here's a column from Europe, from Claude Soula in La Nouvelle Observatoire from France. Losing our culture to Netflix. The American monster of online video, Netflix, is coming to devour French television, said Claude Soula. The service launches in September and hasn't even had to advertise. The French press has been so enamored with it that they devoted pages and pages of coverage. France already has several similar TV on-demand services, but the media weren't interested in those, partly because they have fewer shows and partly because anything that comes from Silicon Valley has an aura that nothing made in France can match. Canal Play, a French streaming service, has tried to fight back with an ad blitz featuring John Malkovich, who appears in commercials dressed as a vampire and says in French, "Since I am immortal, I joined Canal Play, so I can watch thousands of films without stopping." The effort to woo French viewers by using an American actor seems cheap and pathetic, and only underscores how little Canal Play has to offer compared with Netflix. The American company has promised to offer 20% French content, and CEO Reed Hastings even joked that he will produce a new show called House of Versailles. He needn't bother. The French have already cleared their calendars so they can binge-watch Orange is the New Black. In this column from Nigeria, from Robert Obioha at The Sun, how one man imported a deadly virus. The selfish act of a Liberian-American citizen has put countless Nigerians in mortal danger, said Robert Obioha. Liberian Finance Ministry of official Patrick Sawyer was supposed to be under quarantine last month after attending the burial of his sister, who had died of Ebola. Instead, even though he had begun vomiting and knew he was sick, he boarded a plane to Lagos. His wife claims he was simply seeking better medical treatment than was available in Liberia. But if that were true, he would have gone to the U.S., not Nigeria, with its weak health system. It is hard to escape the conclusion that he was trying to infect our country. Already, the doctor and two nurses who treated him are dead, and the disease has affected every aspect of our human relations. Nigerians hug and kiss when we meet. We shake hands in church, and we take communion by opening our mouths to receive the wafer directly from the priest's hands. All these behaviors have been upended. Our only solace is that Sawyer traveled by air and was rushed to the hospital directly from the airport. If he had entered the city through land borders, only God knows how many people would have died from the virus. Turning now to the last word. Baseball's danger zone. When a foul ball rockets into the stand, said Christine Van Dusen, fans have less than 1 second to react. Fred Fletcher doesn't watch baseball anymore, but one night in May, he got a text from a friend. Something had happened at that evening's Atlanta Braves game. An 8-year-old boy had been hit in the head by a line drive foul off the bat of Milwaukee Brewer Carlos Gomez during the 7th inning. In bed with the volume on low so he wouldn't wake his wife, Fletcher watched the 11 o'clock news and then turned on a replay of the game. He didn't see the boy, but when the ball rocketed into the stands behind the first base dugout and the batter dropped to a knee in prayer, Fletcher began to weep. Fletcher is married and has 3 daughters. The 2 youngest are twins. Not quite 4 years ago, when the twins were 6, the family went to see the Braves play the Mets at Turner Field. They sat in row 10 of section 116L, just behind the visitor's dugout along the third base line. The view from these seats is astounding. When the opposing pitcher trots back to the dugout after a half inning, you're close enough to see if he shaved that morning. Expletives from the players often make their way to the seats. So do foul balls. The evening of August 30th, 2010, was postcard perfect. 81 degrees, partly cloudy, a light breeze. My husband and I were there sitting, as chance would have it, 10 rows behind the Fletchers, with our son, just 7 months old at the time. By the top of the fourth inning, the Fletcher girls had finished their cotton candy. It was a school night, so Fletcher was thinking they should leave soon. Melky Cabrera, then a Brave switch hitter, was batting left-handed against right-handed reliever Elmer Dessens from the Mets. On the first pitch to Cabrera, Dessens threw an 88-mile-per-hour fastball on the inside part of the plate. Cabrera's swing, so quick and effortless as to seem almost an afterthought, connected solid but late. On the telecast, the ball disappears from the screen as if it were never there. How fast was it going? We don't know for sure, but a line drive from a major league batter can easily exceed 100 miles per hour. We know some other things. We know that a baseball weighs 5 ounces. We know that force equals mass times acceleration. We know that Fred Fletcher's 6-year-old daughter, whom he well identified only as A, was sitting precisely 144 feet from home plate. The laces on her sneakers were knotted in neat bows, and she, well, not just she, but everyone around her, had less than 1 second to react to Cabrera's line drive. Less than 1 second. In the early days of baseball, there was no netting anywhere. The seating behind home plate became known as the slaughter pen owing to the number of fan injuries from foul balls. It wasn't until 1879 that the Providence Grays became the first professional team to install netting behind home plate. Other teams, from the pros to little leagues, eventually followed suit and put up some sort of protection. Still, this didn't stop baseball from becoming the most dangerous sport to watch, even more so than ice hockey, in large part because of baseball's ubiquity. Since the mid-19th century, about 120 spectators at baseball games of all kinds have been killed by foul balls, including most recently a 39-year-old mother of two at a San Angelo, Texas Colts game in 2010, and an East Carolina University fan in 2012. At a typical major league game, 35 to 40 batted balls fly into the stands. For many fans, this is as much a part of the experience as beer and peanuts. They bring their weathered gloves and wait for a ball to loop lazily in the sky before plummeting toward their seats. Line drive foul balls are different. In humans, there is no such thing as an instant response. What we see must be interpreted by the brain, and that process can take a tenth of a second. If a ball is traveling at 100 miles per hour, it will have already covered a dozen feet before you even realize it's headed towards you. That, of course, assumes you're actually paying attention. Even professional baseball players, paid millions of dollars for their reflexes and hand-eye coordination, get clocked once in a while. Fans get beaned, popped in the eye, whacked in the chest. How often? It's impossible to say for certain. You can find data on fatalities, but injuries, those are harder to find, said Robert Gorman, an author who studies ballpark injuries. Major League Baseball doesn't want to know. They will tell you they don't know. But it's not that the information doesn't exist. Every park has a first aid station, and I promise you the people in those stations are keeping track of everything. If someone gets an aspirin, that's recorded. But the teams refuse to track these injuries. After Cabrera's bat connected with Dessen's pitch, Fletcher heard someone yell, "Watch out!" He saw a flash of white, then he heard a sickening smack, and then there was blood, and his wife was passing his crying daughter to him. He lifted her into his arms, her skinny legs dangling over the crook of his arm. Her face was buried in his chest. The game had already resumed. Indeed, it had barely paused, except for a quick wince from Cabrera and the sight of Mets catcher Josh Stoll rising and slowly reaching for his mask. But in Section 116L, everyone was looking at the man who was racing his bleeding daughter up the steps. From Section 116L to the nearest first aid station is a 2-minute brisk walk. The Fletchers, with Fred carrying their injured daughter, certainly made it less than that. After being sped off to Children's Health Care of Atlanta Hospital, the little girl fell unconscious. Medics loaded her onto a gurney and wheeled her away for emergency surgery. This was around midnight. Hours later, the doctors came to the waiting room and told the Fletchers that their daughter had suffered numerous fractures in her skull, which had to be mended with metal plates. 31 little pieces, Fletcher said, and they put her skull back together. She was stable. She was going to live. Such good news, such a relief, but Fletcher wondered, what kind of life? The doctors moved her to intensive care. She slept for a long time, Fletcher said. My wife and I didn't leave her bedside. And then she finally woke up, and she recognized us. She said, Daddy, Mommy. God, we were so relieved. Then she wanted out. She did not want to be in a hospital, hated doctors. After having spent less than 72 hours in the intensive care unit, she went home with her family, her head wrapped in gauze. She's a fighter, Fletcher said. She went to a speech pathologist, a physical therapist, the neurosurgeon, an ophthalmologist, a series of doctors for about 6 months. But she went back to school maybe a month after the injury. Fletcher won't disclose further details on her condition. At night, when Fletcher couldn't sleep, he Googled the words foul ball injury and took notes on what he saw. For months after, questions buzzed in his head like a swarm of bees. Why did the safety nets cover only the seats behind home plate and just a bit outside of that? Why aren't the teams in the league doing more to keep spectators safe? Are they waiting for a kid to get killed? What can I do to stop that from happening? Nothing, he realized, unless I sue the Braves. The courts aren't often kind to people who sue over foul ball-related injuries. Of 82 foul ball cases from 1913 to 2008, only 19 were decided in favor of the plaintiffs. Typical are cases like the one in 1950 when a spectator sued the Boston American League Baseball Company after she was hit in the face by a foul ball during a game against the Yankees. The court ruled that because she had gone to games before and knew that foul balls often ended up in the stands, she knew the risks, and the ballpark could not be held responsible. Even after most baseball stadiums put up nets behind home plate, spectators continued to get injured. So to clarify who was liable and when, most states adopted some form of the baseball rule. Essentially, it says that stadium owners are not negligent if they install adequate screens where the potential danger is the greatest, the seats directly behind home plate. The baseball rule varies somewhat from state to state, and Georgia doesn't have a defined baseball rule on the books. That's what the Braves' attorneys have been focusing on in the Fletcher suit, first filed in 2012. They're asking the courts to institute an explicit form of the rule. Fletcher's lawyers say the century-old baseball rule doesn't take into account how baseball is changing. The game is getting faster. The players are getting stronger. So it's becoming more dangerous for fans who aren't behind the nets, says E. Michael Moran, one of Fletcher's attorneys. The case has stalled in part because the two sides are fighting over whether it's the job of the courts or of the lawmakers to institute the baseball rule. Should such a rule be instituted at all? Update. After this story originally went to press, the State Court of Appeals ruled not to adopt the baseball rule, meaning the case can proceed. On the last day of June, after an 11-day road trip, the Braves returned home to host the Mets. I bought seats in the same row and section where the Fletchers had sat almost 4 years before. Down here, just a couple of rows behind the dugout, you really do feel like you're in the game, especially when foul balls start zinging over your head. In the row behind me were Travis Conley and his three children, 6-year-old Mason, 9-year-old Harrison, and their 16-year-old sister, Allie. kindly told me that he once saw a 20-something guy get hit by a foul ball at Wrigley Field. It wasn't a line drive, but it looked like it hurt. Still, Conley isn't afraid to have his three children sit in an unprotected area, and he doesn't want the team to add more safety screens. "I don't like watching the game through nets," he said, "and really, if you worried about everything that can happen, you and your kids would never leave the house." I agree with that last point, in theory, but I couldn't help worrying about the little girl to my right, holding up a red foam finger while sipping a Capri Sun and searching for her image on the Jumbotron. I wanted to turn around and tell the Conley family to move to seats where there are nets to block foul balls, where the risk of getting hit in the head by a 100-mile-per-hour line drive is non-existent. But this is just a baseball game, right? Nobody comes here thinking he or she will get hurt. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the August issue of Atlanta Magazine. An obituary for you. The Gandhi director who campaigned against injustice. Richard Attenborough, 1923-2014. In the winter of 1962, Richard Attenborough discovered the obsession that would consume the next two decades of his life. An Indian expat in London had pressed a biography of Mahatma Gandhi into his hands, and after reading a few pages while vacationing in Switzerland, the actor and director felt compelled to make a film about the Indian leader, whose nonviolent campaign against the British colonial rule led his country to independence in 1947. Few others shared his passion. He struggled to raise money from Hollywood executives, one of whom predicted there would be no audience for a little brown man in a sheet carrying a beanstalk. Attenborough ended up producing the film himself, mortgaging his house and selling his cars and paintings to keep the project alive. The gamble paid off. Gandhi became an international box office hit on its release in 1982 and won 8 Oscars, including Best Film and Best Director. Born in southern England, Attenborough grew up in a home in which both parents were politically and socially active, said the Los Angeles Times. His parents took in refugees from the Spanish Civil War in the late 1930s. And for 8 years gave a home to 2 orphaned Jewish girls from Nazi Germany. Attenborough's father had hoped he would follow him into academia. Richard's younger brother, David, studied zoology and became a famed broadcaster. But he settled on an acting career at 11 after watching a Charlie Chaplin movie. "I saw people laughing and crying," recalled Attenborough. "I said to myself, I want to do that too." Attenborough made his film debut playing a terrified boy sailor in the 1942 war movie In Which We Serve. But his breakthrough performance came 5 years later as the teenage thug Pinky in Brighton Rock, an adaptation of Graham Greene's novel. Attenborough's baby face and air of menace combined to make it one of his most memorable roles, said the Associated Press. But his youthful looks led Attenborough to be typecast either as a young delinquent or a cowardly serviceman, said the Times. To gain more independence, he moved behind the camera, and in 1969, he made his directing debut with Oh, What a Lovely War, a bleak musical lampoon of World War I. The director would occasionally return to acting. He played the crackpot genius who resurrects dinosaurs in 1993's Jurassic Park, and Kris Kringle in the 1994 remake of A Miracle on 34th Street. But his main focus, said the Sydney Morning Herald, was on using cinema to decry injustice and extol heroes such as Gandhi and Steve Biko, the South African apartheid campaigner whom Attenborough memorialized in 1987's Cry Freedom. Critics accused the director of sanitizing and simplifying the lives of complex historical figures to attract bigger audiences, a point he happily conceded. I'm not interested in appealing to two men and a dog in a barn, he said. In some quarters, popularize is a dirty word, but it is a banner under which I will gladly sail. On the health and science page, life abounds under Antarctic ice. Despite no exposure to sunlight or fresh air for more than a million years, a lake located half a mile beneath the Antarctic ice sheet sustains an entire ecosystem, scientists have confirmed, raising the prospect that life might exist in similar environments elsewhere in the universe. Researchers had long suspected the existence of tiny life forms living below the ice pack, and the effort to prove it has taken 10 years and cost more than $10 million. First, the team had to design a drill that could bore a hole through more than 2,000 feet of ice without introducing bacteria or other contaminants. And then it had to drag more than 1 million pounds of equipment on giant sleds across the frozen terrain. Only then were team members able to begin collecting samples from the subglacial lake. Within these samples, they found roughly 4,000 species of microbes, alive and well. With no other organisms on which to feed, the microbes survive on tiny minerals in the bedrock and sediments. In other words, they eat rock. The first time we went to Antarctica and the first place we selected to drill a hole, we found life, Louisiana State University professor Brent Christner tells Daily Telegraph. So it's not much of a stretch that in similar conditions, like on Jupiter's icy moon Europa, life could exist. When women can't breastfeed. Breastfeed can reduce the risk of postpartum depression, but new moms who try to nurse but can't are much more likely to suffer from it, a new study has found. Researchers at the University of Cambridge analyzed data from 13,998 births and discovered that among women who successfully breastfed, there was a 50% reduction in the risk of postpartum depression, a psychological disorder that affects 1 in 10 new mothers. Among those who wanted to breastfeed but were unable to, however, the risk of depression more than doubled. The mental health benefits of breastfeeding increased for each week of nursing up to 1 month, but any longer-term impact was impossible to determine because few women in the study continued to breastfeed several months after giving birth. The beneficial effects on mood appear to be the result of hormones a woman's body releases during breastfeeding. Researchers say the findings underscore the importance of helping women overcome the guilt and anxiety that can be associated with an inability to breastfeed successfully. It is right to tell mothers it's right to breastfeed, Cambridge sociologist Maria Iakova tells BBC.com. But we also need to give more support to those who did want to breastfeed and to recognize those who are unable to are at a substantially elevated risk. A fungi's deadly tactics. The bizarre mind-controlling ability of the so-called zombie ant fungus are well established. Once it infects its carpenter ant host, the fungus compels the critter to leave its nest, climb a tree, and latch onto the underside of a leaf. When the ant dies, the fungus sprouts a long stalk from the corpse and rains down spores that infect other ants on the forest floor below. But until now, scientists didn't understand why the fungus didn't simply make the host return to its nest, where it could potentially infect millions of other ants. A new study in Brazil has finally provided an explanation. Researchers put infected ant cadavers inside several nests. Not only did the fungus stalk not sprout, but the healthy ants also removed the corpses within a few days. Sending infected ants up a tree, researchers say, is apparently the most effective way to ensure a supply of future hosts. The parasite doesn't need to evolve mechanisms to overcome the effective social immunity that occurs inside the nest, Penn State's David Hughes tells the Washington Post. What a zombie fungi essentially do is create a sniper's alley through which their future hosts must pass. On the Talking Points page, Ice Bucket Challenge, Altruism or Narcissism? What do Oprah Winfrey, Bill Gates, and millions of other Americans have in common, said Ritu Sharma in HuffingtonPost.com? They have all dumped a bucket of ice over their heads as part of this summer's blockbuster viral meme, the hashtag Ice Bucket Challenge. The challenge is simple. Either pour ice water over yourself while being videoed, upload the footage online, and nominate others to do likewise, or send a $100 donation to combat amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, a neurodegenerative disease also known as Lou Gehrig's. But as more than 2.4 million people have flooded Facebook and Twitter with videos of themselves getting soaked, said Will Oramus at Slate.com, the charitable aspect of this narcissistic exercise has become a postscript. Most participants, including the celebrities, simply like to be seen gasping their way through the ice water bath, which is the alternative to making a financial contribution. Let's drop the pointless meme and just donate the damn money. The challenge is admittedly a gimmick, said the Chicago Tribune in an editorial, but it's hard to argue with success. By tapping into the endless vanity that drives social media, the campaign has raised about $90 million since the end of July, 35 times more than ALS Associated raised in the same period last year. Still, is it really wise to suddenly throw all that charity money at a single disease? Asked Felix Salmon in Slate.com. ALS is incredibly rare, with only 5,600 new cases in the U.S. each year. After 30 years of research, scientists have not come close to finding a cure, and it's highly questionable whether a major influx of cash will make any real difference. That $90 million would have relieved more suffering if it had been donated to organizations that provide clean water, medicine, or food to poor people around the world. It's true that only a few people suffer from ALS, said Angelina Fanu in Vice.com. But their suffering is terrible. They watch as their muscles slowly become concave and disappear, and each day claims more of an ALS sufferer's ability to walk, speak, and chew, until eventually complete paralysis sets in. Yes, the ice bucket challenge is imperfect, but it has shined a light on this bleak, unforgiving disease. In fact, it's one of the few things that's given me hope since I got diagnosed with ALS 6 weeks ago at age 29. Twitter. Should it censor violent videos? Twitter has got itself into a tangle, said James Ball in TheGuardian.com. When Islamist terrorists uploaded a video showing the beheading of American journalist James Foley last week, YouTube took it down under its long-running prohibition on violent content. But Twitter took the YouTube ban a step further, removing all links to the video and banning users who shared it. The social media site has always prided itself on its commitment to freedom of expression. Its former general counsel once called Twitter the free speech wing of the free speech party. Up to now, Twitter also has absolved itself of any moral and legal responsibilities for what users tweet by insisting it is a platform, not a publisher. So why is it now turning into an editor and a censor? Twitter made the right call, said Stephen Glover in the Daily Mail. Jihadist porn dehumanizes its viewers by turning grotesque violence into a form of entertainment. And for a small number of disaffected Muslim men, such videos are a turn-on and could inspire them to join ISIS or commit similar atrocities. If anything, we should be applauding Twitter for recognizing its new responsibilities, said David Weinberger in CNN.com. With millions of people using the site as a news source, it has chosen to accept some of the norms of journalism, namely, not subjecting users to unnecessarily graphic material. As for the complaints about freedom of speech, Twitter is a private company, so it does not have to post anything it finds objectionable. Legally, that's true, said Glenn Greenwald on TheIntercept.com. But it's also worrisome since just a few internet companies wield so much influence over the flow of information. Twitter has more than 300 million active users, roughly equivalent to the U.S. population. Facebook has 1.23 billion active users. Who decides what kind of idea or information these people are not permitted to see, hear, or read? We are nearing the point where an idea banished by Twitter, Facebook, and Google all but vanishes from public discourse entirely. But who gave these companies such power, asked Dan Gilmore in TheAtlantic.com. We did. If we continue to spend most of our time online on services owned by two or three private companies, we're making our own beds. It's time to wake up to what's happening. Obama and golf, an optics problem. Sometimes a round of golf is just a round of golf, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. And sometimes it reveals the essence of a man. President Obama's decision last week to hit the links on his Martha's Vineyard vacation and yuck it up with pals immediately after delivering an emotional address on the brutal beheading of journalist James Foley was a stunning display of his disconnection from his job as the nation's leader. Simple decency and respect for Foley's horrified parents should have persuaded the golfer-in-chief to give up his tea time for at least one day. Even Democrats are admitting that Obama is detached, dialing it in, contemptuous of events that interfere with his plans, said Matthew Continetti in NationalReview.com. His golfing, dancing, dining, and partying with elite friends on the vineyard while terrible things were happening in Iraq, Syria, Ukraine, and Ferguson, Missouri, only confirmed the impression that he's checked out of its troubled presidency. That's unfair, said Clarence Page in the Chicago Tribune. U.S. presidents live inside a big wired cocoon, and while Obama was on the vineyard, he made 9 calls to foreign leaders over various crises, had daily intelligence briefings, and dispatched Attorney General Eric Holder to conduct a federal investigation in Ferguson. Since he took office in 2009, Obama has taken a mere 125 days of vacation, compared with George W. Bush's 407 vacation days at his Texas ranch and at the family compound in Maine. All hardworking people need occasional breaks to restore themselves, especially presidents. Yes, Obama is entitled to a vacation, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. His problem is his habit of acting as if the normal rules of political behavior don't apply to him. George W. Bush quit playing golf after the Iraq War began in 2003, simply because he felt it didn't look right for the president to be strolling the links while Americans faced death abroad. Though I generally support Obama, said Rick Unger in Forbes.com, I was chagrined to see him golfing the same day an American was beheaded by terrorists. One of the president's jobs is to serve as our collective representative and, yes, to feel the nation's pain. The classiest thing he could have done would have been to take a quick helicopter ride to New Hampshire to comfort James Foley's family. To tee off instead demonstrates a coldness that's disturbing. And a few notes here. At least 191,000 people have been killed since Syria's civil war erupted in March 2011, according to a new UN report. That number is more than double the 92,901 deaths estimated by the organization for the first 2 years of the conflict. two fundraising websites for Ferguson, Missouri. Police officer Darren Wilson, who shot teen Michael Brown, have raised more than $402,700 from 9,670 donors. Two fundraising pages for Brown had raised $268,190 from 9,000 donors. People in Belarus drink more alcohol than anyone else in the world, consuming the equivalent of 17.5 liters of pure alcohol per person a year. Americans drink 9.2 liters of pure alcohol per capita a year, while people in Pakistan drink the least, just 0.1 liters. The two U.S. missionaries who were treated for Ebola at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta have recovered and were discharged last week. Dr. Kent Brantley and Nancy Wrightbowl, 59, no longer show any evidence of the Ebola virus and pose no public health threat, hospital officials said. The famed green monster at Boston's Red Sox Fenway Park, a 37-foot, 2-inch high wall in left field, has about 164,630 small dents from batted baseballs, according to a computer study of photos of the wall. Some of the dents have been hit at least six times. On the poll watch, 72% of whites think the police do a good job of treating blacks and whites equally. Only 36% of blacks do. Just 6% of blacks say police do a good job of using an appropriate amount of force, while 41% of whites say police generally use force appropriately. 62% of Americans agree that the U.S. government should not pay ransoms to free hostages being held by terrorists. 21% think it should. And we'll finish up with a quote from Theodore Roosevelt, quoted in the Montreal Gazette. Knowing what's right doesn't mean much unless you do what's right. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.